wanted to read a passage to you before we start. It should be a pretty familiar passage. Pastor Aaron preached from this not long ago, but I thought it's a good summary of what we've attempted to do over the last two semesters as we wind things down this morning. It's from James chapter 3. It says this, "Who is wise and understanding among you? By his good conduct, let him show his works in the meekness of wisdom. But if you have bitter jealousy and selfish ambition in your hearts, do not boast and be false to the truth. This is not the wisdom that comes down from above, but is earthly, unspiritual, demonic. For where jealousy and selfish ambition exist, there will be disorder and every vile practice. But the wisdom from above is first pure, then peaceable, gentle, open to reason, full of mercy and good fruits, impartial and sincere. A harvest of righteousness is sown in peace by those who make peace." It is more than interesting that as James talks about wisdom, the kind of wisdom that we've been studying through the last two semesters, that he judges the possession of wisdom by its fruit. So he says, there are lots of people who will claim to be wise. We all know this to be the case. There are lots of people who will believe that they are wise. And yet, James gives us some pretty good tests for determining whether or not a person actually is wise. And the simple test, this fruit that is shown in works that bring peace. And that's kind of how he boils it down, and he says it in four or five different ways there. But and just to be clear, he is not simply talking about interrelational peace. That is to say that wisdom always brings about you and I being happy with one another. It's not just to say that. It is to say the kind of peace that we are all looking for individually. The kind of peace that comes from a heart that believes it is doing and pursuing the will of God. The kind of peace that comes in a heart where a person does not have to be anxious all the time about the choices that they're making and the decisions that they've made. But to be able to say, I know, insofar as a person can know, that I have done everything I could do to seek the wisdom from God in this situation. I have done my best at it. And as the familiar old expression goes, the duty is mine and the consequences are God's. And so I can be at peace about the consequences, about the process by which I made this decision because of the way I went about it. And when that doesn't happen, you won't have peace because you'll say, you know what? This was about selfish ambition. That's a phrase that gets used twice by James here. And I think that's at least for me, that phrase resonates a lot in decision making. Why did I make this decision? The phrase selfish ambition should be in there somewhere. And so then you wrestle with that. You say, ooh, I'm not sure that was a good decision. I'm not sure that was the right way to handle that. I'm not sure that was the way to seek an outcome. And I have no peace. But when instead I pursue the wisdom that comes from God, not out of jealousy, not out of ambition, but out of personal meekness, if I am open to reason, isn't it interesting that phrase is in there? Open to reason. If I am full of mercy, impartial, sincere, then I may have peace. And I think that's a valuable way for us to wrap up what we've talked about for two semesters. These are the things that we believe. This is the way we use the things that we believe to make really important decisions that come up in our lives. But what we really all want to know at the end of the day is, how can I feel good about the decisions that I've made? How can I live with myself in light of the decisions that I have made? And the answer is, if your decisions are made out of selfish ambition, out of bitter jealousy, then you need to repent of those that feeling, that process, and you need to move on. And if your decisions are made in humility, with an openness to reason, in a peaceable, gentle way, then you ought to have peace, because the consequences don't belong to you. So that's where I wanted to begin. I hope that's some of what we accomplished in the last two semesters, was that we didn't just say, what are the three best possible decisions you could make about education or about work? And even though I said I'm not going to tell you the one decision that's right for everybody, maybe I narrowed it down to four. Right? But I hope that's not what we did exactly. I hope what we did is to say, how do I get that list of four? And then how do I make the one? And how do I live at peace in light of picking the one? Because we have to do that a lot. And I think a lot of us carry weight and burden of decisions that have been made in the past that cannot be changed and cannot be undone. And we need to learn simply to hand those things over to God, to repent when necessary, and to be at peace. That's the goal of wisdom. And James says, you know, that if we ask God for wisdom, he's not selfish with his wisdom. He gives it out. He pours it out liberally, more than we ask for, more than we think we want most of the time. If you look for it, it's there. And that's the kind of thing that I hope we've uncovered a little bit this year. So with that out of the way, what do we need to go back and revisit? Or what do we need to clarify? What do we need to dig in a little bit more deeply? What should we talk about so that we feel a sense of completion on what we've done here?
And yeah. Impartiality. I'm assuming that impartiality means your attitude toward another person, not an impartiality on your views.
So he uses two words there. There are two phrases in Greek, two words. Open to reason and impartiality. Open to reason is one that we've all, the opposite of that is one that we've all encountered, and we've encountered it in ourselves, actually. This is the one where we have a conclusion in search of a defense. You've heard of a sermon in search of a text? We have a conclusion in search of a defense. I know what I want to do. I have already made up my mind that this is what I am going to do. But I feel the need, because of social, family, church, relational, whatever type of pressure, I feel the need to build a case for why I am going to do this thing that I already know I'm going to do. And so we involve other people, because that's wisdom, right? As you go out and you seek godly opinions, and you say, hey, Stephen, I'm thinking about doing such and such because blah, 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 and it's the most amazing idea I've ever had. And Stephen, because he's my best friend, he says, well, that's great, Paul, except one problem. It's stupid. It's the stupidest thing you've ever thought about. It's the dumbest thing you've ever wanted to do. It's going to be a disaster. Well, okay, I appreciate your input on that. I'm going to pray about that some. And then I go on and I do what I want to do, right? I'm not open to reason. I'm not willing to have my assumptions challenged. I'm not willing to have my mind changed. I am closed off. I'm sealed off. And what I try to encourage people to do is simply be honest. If you are actually closed off about this decision, if you actually, this is what you're going to do, then just say that. I'm not open to discussion. I don't care what other people's, like, you need to say that out loud, and you need to say it out loud to somebody else, because maybe hearing yourself say it out loud, you'll realize, wow, that's a really terrible thing to say. But you need to be honest about it and say it out loud. This is what I'm going to do. And it'll sound a lot like my children during the week. You're not the boss of me. I know this is going to work. I'm sure of it. And then they go fall off something or break something or catch it on fire. Because that's what happens when you're not open to reason. So this is really important. This is a type of honesty where we're clear with people about what we're looking for. And it can really help people communicate with us, right? Because if I tell you that I really am struggling with the decision and I'm trying to think about what I want to do and I need input and advice, you're going to talk to me, you're going to provide feedback in a certain way. If I tell you I'm not open, I don't want to hear what you have. Like, you'll respond to me hopefully on the more important issue there. But this open to reason is really important. So this is one good thing you could say for Dr. Phil. Like, there's a whole lot of things you could say that are not good. I'm going to say one that is. He asks people my favorite question of all time when it comes to decision making. How's that working for you? Because people say, well, I'm going to do such and such, and it's what they've been doing all along. And he looks at them, and he very calmly says, how's that been working for you? Well, my life's a disaster. My family hates me. I lost my job, and I'm poor. Good, good. You keep at that. That's a winning path. Right? You got to be open to reason. Impartiality. So when we're considering making decisions, one of the things that we have to consider is the impact of that decision on all the people involved. So there's usually me, and this is why it says that you shouldn't make decisions out of selfish ambition, right? Because if you make a decision out of selfish ambition, then the only person who matters is me. There's me, but then there's people I like. So I say, well, we're going to do this thing that involves stealing money from this guy and giving it to the person I like. And the reason that that's a good decision is because they're going to like me when I give them money, so that's a win. And people I like are going to get money, so that's a win. So let's go do it. Let's go steal money from people we don't like and give it to people we do like. No government jokes. All right. And then people I don't like. Well, who cares what the effect on them is? I don't like them. So I have to make this decision. It's going to get us X, Y, and Z, and it's going to have this negative consequence on that other person, but what do I care? I don't even like them. Or that's not the way we would say it. We would say, well, they don't even like us. They don't care what we do. They don't even like us. Well, they care when it affects them. So when we start to make decisions and we're looking at the ramifications, the implications of those decisions on other people and other groups of people, how do we order this list? Well, this is normally the way we order it. And what James is saying is that order is all wrong, utterly wrong. And really, we would be inclined to say, and I understand why people say it as a correction to the way that we are, or let's use neighbors, and then let's use loved ones, and then me. Something like that would be a more appropriate order. James's point is, don't get hung up in trying to order these things. What matters is that you don't stack rank these groups. You certainly rank these groups above yourself. You put everybody above yourself all the time. You should just put everybody above yourself. Ooh, but people abuse that too, right? That's why I'm saying you don't stack rank these things. You have to do the harder thing. It's what we've been talking about for two semesters, isn't it? It would be so easy if we said, here's the formula for making decisions. Impact on people I don't like accounts for 60%. People I do like accounts for 35%. And me accounts for 5%. Plug them in, do the math, you've made your decision. We would love that. You laugh, we would love this. If decision-making was this formulaic and we could just look at it like a math problem and know that we did it right, we would be so happy. But decision-making doesn't work that way. Decision-making requires thoughtfulness in every single aspect of every single decision. So I could look at some decisions in my family and I could say, you know what? We're going to weight the impact of this on mommy 95%. And that's the way this decision is going to be made. And I could look at another decision and I could say, we're going to weight the impact of this decision on mommy 10%. Because in those cases, those were the right ways to approach the decision. And we don't like that so much. It's a lot harder. Does that answer the question? All right. What else? Oops. We talked about entertainment and time. We talked about money. We talked about education. We talked about conflict. We talked about marriage, dating, children, how many, when. We talked about debt. We talked about starting a church, worshiping in a church, leading a church. It's a busy semester. Just stretching. I'll do too. That's generally what these weeks are for, right? We've not touched politics. Yeah. Wisdom in course design. So I think politics is probably neck and neck with education in terms of the things where there is a lot more heat than light and a lot more deterministic rhetoric than the facts would warrant. So what I mean by that is we need to listen more and speak less about politics, and we need to speak with less certainty for other people. So one of the things that I hope we've covered well this semester is that as abused as the quote is, Luther was right that it is not safe nor wise or right to go against your conscience. And once we have, we talked all semester about a law side of the board and a wisdom side of the board and how important it is that these things are 100% non-negotiable. And these things can vary from person to person because the circumstances can be different. But also, even if the circumstances are exactly the same, no two people's consciences are alike. That's just the reality of this, is that when you're dealing with wisdom and you're dealing with conscience, no two people have the same conscience. And even if you account for sanctification and spiritual maturity, I would argue that two equally sanctified, equally spiritually mature people still do not have the same conscience. And that is why when you look at two people who came to a decision about wisdom, and I say they both love Jesus and they both want to please God, and they make a different decision, sometimes it's the case because one of those two people was more mature, had more biblical understanding, and they picked what actually was the wiser of two lawful choices. But sometimes it's not. And the problem that we get into, and I mentioned, you know, we do this with education. How are you going to educate your children? And that's why we ended up talking about that for 3.5 weeks in this class. I don't know if you noticed that as you go back and string together the weeks. 3.5 weeks spent on education. And it's because in the church, we speak with such certainty about things that are not universal truths. This is better. This is the only way. Very, very dangerous talk. And the place where we do that just as much, frankly, is politics. We take things that we feel very strongly about and that we think are so, well, not we think, they are so clear to us. And we confuse personal clarity and conviction with objective reality. And no matter how strong your personal conviction is, if it is not actually on the law side of the board, it is not objective reality. I taught, Davey was there in Winston-Salem for 3 weeks in our Wednesday night prayer meeting leading up to the 2000 and some year elections. That would have been 2012. Leading up to the 2012 elections. And I opened the can of worms myself. Wednesday night prayer meeting, we had a little sort of sack lunch, bring your own dinner, we'll sit together and eat before prayer meeting on Wednesday nights. And So we're sitting around, and I just kind of asked the leading question. You think it's okay for a Christian to vote for President Obama? That was fun. That was fun. And 3 weeks later, we got somewhere. Of course, there's the visceral reaction of absolutely not. And then we had to dig into that. Because I could have just as easily framed the question. If I told you that there was a man who believed that God had made us all itty-bitty gods, and that when we achieve a higher level of understanding, we will get our own universe to be gods over, like him, of the same substance, and the man who believes that should run our country, how many of you would say that we should vote for that man? Well, it depends. What's his view on immigration? What's his view on abortion? Right? That's why politics is so tough, because there are issues wrapped up in politics that we care deeply about and that are moral imperatives. So being against abortion is a moral imperative for a Christian. You can't be indifferent about this. Falls on the law side, right? But let me ask you this. Two questions about that. What specifically about abortion falls on the law side? Well, you should be against it. You shouldn't have it. You shouldn't support it. You shouldn't perform it. All these things are true. Should you talk to people who do? Should you shop at a business of people who do? Should you vote for someone who does? Are those on this side of the board? No, they're not. They're over here. Then you have to ask a second question. Why is abortion on that side of the board? What's the big issue there? What's the problem with abortion? It's a devaluation of life, and actually a termination of life. Devaluation to such an extent that it can be terminated. Is this the only issue affected by politics that has this at its core? Euthanasia? Unmanned drones? Assassination of military combatants? Human trafficking? Is this the only political issue that has as its core problem the devaluation of life? Not at all. There are a lot of them. Now, I'm going to give an extreme example for just a minute. We use the extreme to prove that things are not as black and white as we want them to be. But if I had a candidate who was the most pro-life person you've ever known, okay? Perfect voting record on pro-life issues. But they are pro-assisted suicide. They are pro-assassination of anybody we want to assassinate in any country at any time. They are pro-preemptive war. They think human trafficking isn't that big a deal because most of the time they go into it voluntarily anyway. If I go down the list and every one of those other issues that's about life, they're on the wrong side. What do I do? I at least have to think, don't I? Most of the time, it's not that stark. Most of the time. But it's not the black and white world of everybody who's pro-life is actually pro-life either. A lot of people who are pro-life are anti-abortion, but they're not really pro-life in a lot of other meaningful ways. I can completely understand and not argue with or disagree with someone who comes to the moral conviction that abortion is the life issue of our day, and that when they vote, it is such a priority for them that it's not that it trumps all, because I gave an extreme example, but that for the most part, that position is going to determine how they vote. I can understand the person who thinks that way. I can respect the person who thinks that way. I do not vote that way. And I think that other people who love Jesus and want to live faithful lives may weight these decisions differently. Somebody could look at the office of the president and say, as I look over the Supreme Court, this is not the case for the upcoming election, I'm giving a theoretical, but they could have looked at it in 2012 and said, I'm a Supreme Court watcher. It's a geek thing. I read everything they write. I just follow the Supreme Court. I love it. And I could have told you in 2011, there will be no Supreme Court appointments in this presidential term. Nobody is stepping down. The only possible way it would happen would be if a Republican won the 2016 election and Ruth Bader Ginsburg got pressured by the Democratic National Convention to step down while there was still a Democrat in office. I don't think she's susceptible to that kind of pressure, by the way, but, okay, that's your one argument. And look what happened. How many Supreme Court appointees did Obama have this term? Zero. Outside of a Supreme Court appointees, how influential is a president on the issue of abortion in our current political position? Zero. You don't have to agree with me on that, but this is the way my mind is working. So I say, for that particular office, even though this issue is a moral imperative for me, for this office in this election, it is not the most important factor in voting for me. But do you hear how many times I have to say, for me? And when I sit across the table from someone, and with tears in their eyes and heartbroken, they tell me about the impact of abortion on their lives and the pain that it has caused them and their zeal against it and their earnestness in seeing it outlawed in this country, and they prioritize that in the way they cast every vote, I'm not going to complain about that. I'm not going to criticize that. I'm going to say, I understand. I understand why in your matrix of choosing political candidates, on your scales, that it is so heavy that it just carries the day. I get that. What we need to get is that there are very few people in this room for whom, when we lay out the things that matter about why we vote and how we vote and what percentage impact those things are in this particular candidate, in this particular election, probably no two people in this room have the same view on that.
Where on your matrix do you put the issue of a candidate's character, such as the ability to tell the truth and corrupt all the government?
Yeah, personally I put it pretty high because I would rather have a personal opinion. I would rather have a guy with a lot of positions that I don't agree with, that he's upfront with me going in about what they are, and that he executes them consistently so at least I know what I'm dealing with, than to have people who just lie. But good luck. Let me know when you find that guy to vote for.
How do you track the results?
Here and then there. Go ahead.
Complacency.
Like, people who just raise their hands and say, I'm sick of the whole thing, it's worthless. Yeah, my wife, she just raised her hand.
This
is another place where, boy, you want to hear some of the things that were said in light of the Sunday school, the Wednesday prayer teaching. Where I was baiting a little bit. But some of the things that people said back to me in sincerity, or said to other people in the circle, in sincerity, you have a moral obligation to vote in this election. No, I don't. No, I don't. If the two people on the ballot are, in my estimation, Hitler and Mussolini. I do not have a moral obligation to pick the lesser of two evils. I might have a moral obligation to move to Canada. You do not have a moral obligation to vote. You should take the privilege of voting in a democracy very seriously. You should be eager to participate in the political process in the ways that are afforded to you. But if you, by conscience, decide, I can't have anything to do with this, you don't have to do this. Don't. Sit that one out. So that was one of the really frustrating things that got said. The other really frustrating thing that got said was that if you didn't vote for this candidate, you were voting for the other one. And I kind of chuckled at that, and I said, you know, it's funny, because I was actually in the ballot box, and I know what box I checked, and it wasn't that one. Well, you may as well have been. Okay, but it wasn't. Well, it had the same effect. What do you want from me? It wasn't. If your conscience allows you, and I know we're always voting for the lesser of two evils because everyone in their hearts is evil apart from regeneration. Okay, but we're going to use this language the way human beings use it. If your conscience allows you in a particular case to vote for somebody because you believe they are the lesser of two evils, and you believe that in this particular case that is a good use of your vote and what you would like to do with it, you feel free to do that. Don't tell people that that's what they have to do. Because you're over here. You're in wisdom. And you have made an assessment. They've made an assessment that wisdom for this election is to sit out. Okay. You can have some good-spirited debate with them about that, but you can't put those in moral categories. If you don't do this, you're voting for Hitler. That's the way we talk about this. So I guess my specific answer to your question, Lori, would be I don't think we can get to a point of apathy or indifference about it. I think we need to understand the choices that are before us and do the necessary work to figure out who, if anyone, we can vote for. And then we should do the work of voting for them. If in that work we are discouraged and believe there is no one in good conscience we can vote for, we do not have to participate by voting. We always ought to be participating by prayer. How many of us have prayed, Lord, give us better candidates in 2016? 2% of the class, right? That's a good thing for us to remember to pray. Oh, we got to go here and then back. It's exactly the same thing. Yeah, it is exactly the same problem. If you are in a liberal church and you do not elevate environmental concerns the way we have elevated abortion, then you are anathema to them. It's not unique to conservatives. But it's that language that we all share, which is that we take choices of conscience, admittedly meaningful choices of conscience, but we take choices of conscience and attach to them moral value. As if your conscience is so deficient that this choice you've made is sinful because you didn't make my choice. And that's the really dangerous language. If my conscience can't vote for either one. Now, for us, that's almost never an out because in most states, you can write in a candidate.
Right.
And it is almost never the case that you will be going to the ballot to only vote for one office. And if you tell me I can't vote for somebody for president this year, so I'm not voting, I say, well, what about the 47 other elections that are on your ballot? You know, and we're all, not all, many of us are pretty bad at paying attention to those. And frankly, they're the ones that have bigger impacts on our lives. Who's on your local school board? Who's on your local county commission? Who's your mayor? Who's your governor? Who's your senator? Who's your congressman? Right? Like, those have more meaningful impact on our lives a lot of times than who the president is. And we don't really pay attention to those, and we should. But if you look at both of them, and you're supposed to check a box for one of two people, and you can't. Again, we got to be very careful. My conscience does not allow me to vote against someone. Because that is not my understanding of the democratic process. I don't have a box that says, who are you against? I have two boxes that say, are you for this guy or are you for this gal? My conscience does not allow me to simply check the one that's not the person I hate. If yours does, if you feel this person is such an atrocity that I don't care who's in this box, I will check it. And you've thought that out, and that's what your conscience says, good on you. But don't be so mad at me, and don't get moral imperative on me when I say, I can't. Again, I'm not, see, and that's what I'm saying. When you weigh that out, isn't your representative the one who said that the island was going to get so many people on it was going to capsize? Yeah. Hey, look, I get it. I live here too. Okay. Our goal is to be really thoughtful about these things. And not just to react viscerally, but thoughtlessly. Bruce?
To step back from the political. So that's one question.
One of the challenges, so you are very right and wise to say that few of us are experts on these issues or these technologies. Unfortunately, one of the post-postmodern accepted ideas in our culture is that because I'm not an expert, no one is. Right? And then all opinions become equally valid. And so let's use the example of contraceptives. It ain't that hard. Just because we don't know the answer, right? I don't understand. Actually, there are some pretty objective lines that you can draw. We just don't want to draw them. And so when reality interferes with my desire, we pretend there's ambiguity. Oh, well, you know, a lot of different, I read Wikipedia in there, you know, there's lots of opinions. And right. That doesn't mean that every single form of contraceptive is that clear, black or white. Most of them are. Because the reality is, for Christians, we have a very, very, on this one, very easy to understand, black and white. There is a difference between preventing conception and taking that which is conceived and destroying it. That is a categorical moral difference. And so we actually do have the ability to look at these options and say, does it do this or does it do that? Now, that doesn't answer the wisdom question. So lots of people could take options that are morally acceptable within a Christian worldview and say, I choose not to be involved with this. That's wisdom. But what we can't do is take ones that should be excluded on the basis of the moral reality and say, well, there's ambiguity here. It's not real clear. It's not certain. It's unlikely. That's an interesting term, right? It's unlikely that this would happen. A lot of things are unlikely. Right? Is it possible? Would a reasonable person believe this could occur? Right? That's just a different type of question. And so I do think we need to have vigorous discussions, robust debates with light, not heat. They'll get loud sometimes because we're passionate, and these are issues that are sensitive, and it's okay. I think we ought to be okay getting loud with one another and being and recognizing that we're trying to get to the truth. That's our goal here. And some of these things are hard to wrestle with. But more times than we could exhaust, we actually could figure out if something's on the law side of the board or the wisdom side. And frankly, I think that is a major role of the church, is to encourage people that those types of discussions and debates should be for that purpose, to determine whether something is on the law or wisdom side of the board. And then when we're debating things that are on the wisdom side of the board about which is more wise, those are the times we don't need to raise our voices. Those are the times we don't need to get intense. Those are the times we need to listen and be very meek and very gracious with one another. And what I fear is that instead of doing that, we just throw a whole bunch of things that are on the law side of the board into the wisdom side. We just keep dumping them over. If any two people disagree, well, okay, well, then it's wisdom and my conscience is... No, your conscience is wrong. Your conscience is sinfully wrong. Let me help you with this. You can't talk that way. That's terrible. Nobody would do that, right? I said, look, I've had infants in my household. I find them to be pretty useless. They don't contribute much to society. They're very needy. I don't even think they think. So, I mean, my dad makes this argument with some of his colleagues who participate in abortion. What's the difference? What's the difference? 4 weeks remaining inside of a womb? 4 weeks outside of a womb? What's the difference? This one keeps you awake at night. That's the difference. Well, this keeps me awake at night. Daphne was kept awake the whole time. So we need to, the role of the church, to answer your question about what's the role of the church. The role of the church is to keep us focused and to speak very clearly about those things which are on the law side of the board and those things which are not. And about the things that are on the law side of the board, and we just in passing the concept of church discipline has come up several times. That's the only thing it needs to be about. And it needs to be so clear about that. And it needs to be so consistent because we must call true, true. And we must call false, false. We cannot call wise true. We cannot call unwise in our eyes in a particular situation false. We've got to be really careful with our labels because that matters a lot.
I think in hindsight, the 3 million or so people that are estimated to have stayed home and did not vote in the 2012 election because it wasn't, because it was a Mormon, it was Obama's opponent. In hindsight, they're probably realizing, ooh, gosh, maybe we should have voted.
No.
Look at the situation.
No, now. No, 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 you don't get to do this. No, you don't get to do it. You're trying to do after-the-fact moralizing. That's what it is. It's after-the-fact moralizing. You have no idea what would have happened in the last 4 years under Romney. I'm not saying whether it's better or worse. I'm saying you have no idea. But what you are declaring as a fact is that it would have been better. And I reject the fact. You don't know.
Not 100%.
No, you don't. You know 0%. No. No is a binary choice. You either know or you not know. And you not know. And this is what we do before the election to people too, is we say before the election, you know it will be worse. No, I don't. I really have thought about it. I obsess, ask my wife, I spend way too much time thinking about politics. Way too much time. But you don't know. You and you don't, here's the thing. What does that mean? And I'm picking on you, of course. But what does that mean? What does it mean?
It usually means what makes us uncomfortable, inconvenienced, or feel bad.
And even at its best, let's take it at its best, because that's how you mean it, is at its best, is that in your matrix of issues that matter most, Obama handled those issues worse than Romney would have. That's what you mean by worse. Makes complete sense. I totally understand it. But what you're assuming is that my matrix should be the same as yours. Because if your matrix is abortion, taxes, all right. Family. Well, no, hold on, because his is not obviously not that. So your view on religious liberty is the one I was looking for. The one you put up here is religious liberty. That's the one he's had the most negative impact on, right? So this is your matrix, and this is, generalizing. One, two, three, four. That's your matrix. And you can say objectively, which I was picking on you, but you could say objectively that you are 99% sure that Obama's record on these things is worse than Romney's would have been.
Absolutely.
You're absolutely saying that. But here's what I'm saying. This wasn't my matrix. Mine was torture, preemptive war. Go down the list. Yeah. No, no. You don't get to make my list. Because what you cannot say objectively is that Romney would have done a darn thing about that. You cannot say objectively that he would have had one less drone strike. You cannot say objectively that there would have been one less human being as collateral damage of a preemptive war. Those things don't matter as much to you as these things, and that is perfectly okay. Those are exactly the types of decisions of conscience we're talking about. But you can't tell me I made a mistake, a moral mistake, because my list was different than your list. Now, we should sit at a coffee shop, and we should fight about it, and we should have some fun. We should, because it's fun, and it's iron sharpening iron, and it's great, and we should go back and forth, and we should figure out, why do I have such a view on this the way that I do? Well, I'm younger. I haven't seen historically some of the things that you've seen. I have a different understanding of how these, like, I need to learn from that, and maybe I could help you out on some of these other things that you haven't thought about the way I've thought about. That's what we have to do. But when we're done, we have to say, brother, sister, I love you. I believe you love the Lord. I believe you're seeking wisdom. And whoever you go in that ballot booth and check their box, or if you don't check a box at all, that is in your conscience an act of obedience to God through your conscience. That. And so then we can't say things like, well, your conscience messed up.
Right?
Yeah, I mean, I'm in every decision that is not sin or not sin binary, I'm held accountable for the way in which I go about that decision. Whether it's voting or whether I buy this car or that car. Right? I'm in the same level held accountable. Vlad? Do we have time? Yep, we got 6 minutes. Yeah. So what is the role of prayer in decision making? What's the role of prayer in all things in Christian life? It's huge. Pray, right? It is the fuel by which we enjoy communion with God. He says he will give wisdom to us if we ask for it, so we do that in prayer. He says that his Spirit will intercede for us in ways we can't intercede for ourselves, so he does that in prayer. He says that he will meet with us in prayer, so we have some, not to get too mystical on you, but we have some experience of his presence through prayer. So prayer is absolutely and utterly essential to every decision that we make. A couple things we have to be careful of. Does God speak outside of his word? I'd like to read for you Hebrews chapter 1. I don't need to read it for you. Here's what it says. That in the past, your forefathers, God spoke in all kinds of ways. Dreams, visions, some crazy stuff in the Old Testament. Dice, Urim and Thummim.
Donkey.
God spoke. Who knew what was going to come next? Cloud, pillar of fire. But in these last days, he has spoken. Greek has a lot of verb tenses. This is the one that says done, finished, there is no more. This is the it is finished kind of verb. He has spoken in his Son. And the apostles flesh that out for us, that the testimony about Jesus and from Jesus, which is what we call the New Testament, that is the speaking. And it is done. And God has nothing else to say to us until he comes again. Now, he's gracious that he takes these words and he brings them to us in a lot of different ways. We can get wisdom from a friend. We can get recollections of Bible verses that we've memorized as children. We can sing hymns and we can hear great preaching. God still speaks. The question is, what is the content of that speech? And the answer is this. This is the only content. The Bible is the only content of God's speech from now until he comes again. So what we have to be very careful with is when we say, I prayed about it, which is fantastic, and we say, I prayed about it, and God told me to move to Topeka. Show me the page. Show me the page where God told you to move to Topeka. Because if it's not in here, then what's the difference between you saying, God told me to move to Topeka, which I'm pretty indifferent about, and God told me, you need to sell your house and give me all your money. Because God told me. God doesn't say things that are not authoritative. So if we're allowed to say, God told me to quit my job, and believe that that comes with any sort of weight or authority, if you believe that, then seriously, God told me to tell you to sell your house and give me your money. Just as authoritative as what you think God told you. So that's what we got to be really careful with. What does God do in prayer? Well, this is the mystic part that people don't like. In having a sense of his presence through prayer, through the thought and the wrestling that is required in prayer, through the soul searching that prayer brings about, he can give us a sense of peace and confidence and fortitude about the decisions that we're making. And so we don't say to someone else, God told me this. We say, you know, as I have prayed about it, I feel convinced. Well, now I'm making a statement about my feelings. That can be a completely valid feeling. And in fact, God operates that way. So that's okay. That's good. That's the way we should speak. There's a big difference between God told me to go to the grocery store and buy a cantaloupe and to say, I felt convinced that I ought to buy the cantaloupe. Probably need to pray about more significant things. But that's the role of prayer. Prayer doesn't teach us something new. Prayer can remind us of the things of God that we know, and prayer can give us a sense of peace and conviction, or a lack of peace and lack of conviction about the decisions that we're trying to make. Sure. I can't help it if they're lying, and I can't help it if they're making it up, but I can't help it if they're wrong. I'm just saying that God actually will work that way if you let him. Yeah. And sometimes even if you don't, he'll break you down, but